Good morning. My name is Dean. I'm the lead pastor here at LifePoint. If today is your first day, we are thrilled that you are here with us. We started a series last week called Camouflage Christmas, and the idea is that the Advent was evident throughout the Old Testament. The way that we've said that is that the proof is in the prophecy. So we're looking at the ways that the Old Testament writers and prophets talked about Jesus and see how they're fulfilled in his life. And the miracle really there is that those things were said hundreds, sometimes thousands of years before Jesus actually arrived. And so because of that, there were certain people that even though it was camouflaged, they saw it. So they were looking forward to the coming of this man, Messiah, the one they thought was their super, kind of superhero. When I think about superhero, I don't know who you think about, but I think about Superman. And depending upon your generation, right, you've got your own version of Superman. And I see that. But what happened with Jesus is that even though they were looking for Superman to show up, what they really got in the person of Jesus, in their minds, in their view, was more like this guy, right? Clark Kent's not very impressive. He's kind of clumsy and bumbling all the time. He wasn't very good with women and all those kinds of things. He was just okay at his job, but don't let that brother find a phone booth, right? Because when he did, he becomes this incredible superhero. And Superman was strong, and he was brave, and he was good, and he had Lois, and he never needed counseling, right? Even though he wore blue tights, knee-high red boots, and a cape, he never needed any of that, kind of like we do, because he was, you know, able to leap tall buildings in a single bound, and all of those miraculous things that he did. And Israel was looking for this man, Messiah. This one who would come, this one who would rescue them. And so last week we talked about how Jesus was the long-awaited for prophet. Remember, we talked about how three offices in the Old Testament: prophet, priest, and king. Jesus was the prophet. He stood between God and the people, right? And the prophet would speak to the people, facing the people, speaking for God to the people. This week we're going to flip that. We're going to talk about how Jesus is the priest. And priests in the Old Testament stood between God and the people, but they faced God speaking for the people in behalf of the people to God. No one in the Old Testament fulfilled all three offices: prophet, priest, and king. Only Jesus does that when he shows up. So here's the prophecy in the Old Testament, Psalm 110, verse 4. The Lord has taken an oath and will not break his vow. You, this Messiah that they were looking forward to. This is 700 years or so before Jesus ever comes. You are a priest forever in the order of Melchizedek. So the question then becomes, was this prophecy fulfilled in the person of Jesus? And the writer of Hebrews in the New Testament, in chapter 7, says yes and shows us how. So Hebrews chapter 7, verse 1 says, "For this Melchizedek, king of Salem, priest of the Most High God, met Abraham returning from the slaughter of the kings and blessed him. And to him, Abraham apportioned a tenth part of everything. He is first by translation of his name, king of righteousness, and then he is also king of Salem, that is, king of peace. He is without father or mother or genealogy, having neither beginning of days nor end of life, but resembling the Son of God, he continues a priest forever." See how great this man was to whom Abraham the patriarch gave a tenth of the spoils. And this describes a scenario all the way back in the book of Genesis, chapter 14. Abraham meets this guy named Melchizedek. Melchizedek, translated in Hebrew, means king of righteousness. It says he was also king of Salem. Salem is the word for peace. There's no genealogy given for this Melchizedek. We don't know where he comes from, if he had a start. There's no talk of his death. We don't know how or if Melchizedek ever died. And he gives Abraham bread and wine. In ministry, he gives him bread and wine. So let's just summarize that for a minute. There's the king of righteousness, the king of peace. We don't know if he was ever born. We don't know if he ever died. And he gives Abraham bread and wine. Does that sound like somebody else maybe that you know, like, maybe this is one of those moments in the Old Testament where God shows up in the person of Christ, shows up in the Old Testament, and he points us to the reality of this coming Messiah. Now, the question, I guess, then is, well, why does Abraham need a priest? Well, you heard in the verses that we read that Abraham was coming from a war. He was coming from a military conflict. And I don't know if you've had the opportunity, I have, to talk to some of our soldiers who've come home, whether they're older in terms of the Korean conflict or the Vietnam War, or today from the Desert Storm or the Iraqi War, whatever it is, who have been in a battle, who've been in military, who've taken someone else's life. And there's just a weight that comes with doing that. And there's some internal law, right? There's something internal where they come home, there's trauma and there's PTSD. They have to work their way through. And I think that Abraham comes and meets Melchizedek, this priest, this representative in his mind for him to God. And he is so grateful to meet him because he knows there's this internal law that he's trying to struggle through and deal with. And so if there's a law, then you have to ask the question, can the law justify? And the law really can't justify you. The law really just, it just reveals you. Now, even though Abraham was around before the law was ever around, what you and I know about the law, right, is that the New Testament says that the law is a tutor. So the law was given to us to point us to Christ. It was actually given to train us that the law wasn't going to be able to get us there, but it was to point us towards our need for Christ. Our problem is that we tend to treat the law like a substitute teacher instead of a tutor. We tend to build a system of righteousness whereby we declare ourselves to be good people or good enough people compared to other people that God should bless us, hear us, and respond to us, give us a certain kind of comfortable life because of the good things that we do and the way that we keep the law. But the fact that the law exists just really tells us that we're on trial. That there's this system, there's this level of righteousness that somehow we have to attain to. So how do we deal with that? Here's what verse 11 says in Hebrews chapter 7. Now, if perfection had been attainable through the Levitical priesthood or through the law, for under it, people received the law, what further need would there have been for another priest to arise after the order of Melchizedek? So the author of Hebrews says, look, you're looking at two different types of priests here. You've got Melchizedek, this king of righteousness, king of peace, and then you've got the order of Aaron. Aaron was the first high priest, and out of Aaron came this whole system of the Levitical priesthood. And you know how that would work, right? Someone would come during, let's say, the Passover, the annual celebration. I would come with my family. I would go into the priest, and the priest, I'd confess my sins, right? And the priest would represent me to God. God, here's Dean. Dean's a slacker. He needs forgiveness. So here's a sacrifice that's going to be a covering, albeit temporary, for his sins and for the sins of his family. Because Dean has broken the law. And the more that I learn about the law, it's not really helpful. I bought this book this week. It's called The Complete Golf Manual. All of the laws, all of the rules of golf are in this book, along with some tips for how to better your game. Now, I sit down, I read all of the rules of golf. Does this help my golf game? I golf about 2 times a year. Does this help me? No. The laws of golf, the rules of golf, the more I read them, the more I realize how bad I am, right? Because these rules tell me that whenever I hit my ball behind a tree and I take my foot and just wedge it out there so I've got a clear shot, that's wrong. That's a penalty stroke. These rules teach me that when I hit my ball in the water, which I regularly do, and I just go up there and drop one, probably in a better spot than where it went into the water and hit my second shot, that don't charge myself a penalty stroke, that I'm breaking a rule. That whenever I hit my ball into the rough and I try and figure out a way to get my ball out of the rough, and most times I just reach down and pick it up and set it in a completely different space to give myself a better lie and a better shot, and I don't take a penalty stroke, that's wrong. That I'm actually really disqualifying myself from being able to play the very game that I'm playing. The rules of golf don't help me at all. They actually make me worse. Now, long term, the rules of golf can be helpful because the rules of golf should teach me don't aim where the trees are. Aim further this way. Don't hit the ball where the water is. Hit the ball far short, right, of the water. They should help me in the longer, but in the short run, they're not helpful to me at all. And the laws in the Old Testament aren't necessarily designed in the short run to be helpful. As a matter of fact, they're created to point you in a specific direction. What direction is that? Verse 23, for the former priests, though they were many in number, because they were prevented by death from continuing in office, but he, he, this high priest that they're talking, this high priest after the order of Melchizedek, this Messiah, but he holds the priesthood permanently because he continues forever. Consequently, he is able to save to the uttermost those who draw near to God through him, since he always lives to make intercession for them. So what the author of Hebrews says is, just like Abraham needed an advocate, Abraham needed an attorney standing in front of God representing him, what you have is you have this Messiah, this Jesus, looking backwards now, seeing him, you see him as your advocate. Now, in their world, if you got in trouble in a foreign country, you couldn't represent yourself. You had to hire an advocate. So maybe you don't look good to the surrounding culture because you're a foreigner. We don't know what we think about you in their world, right? And so you're going to sit in jail. Maybe you don't have any currency in their country. Maybe you don't speak the language. So how are you going to defend? You can't defend yourself. So what do you? The good news for you is you speak the language as good as your advocate does. You don't look like you. You look as good as your advocate does. And so what, you don't have the currency of that country, you hire this advocate, maybe you're gonna have to work that off after a system of time or however, but you know what, you've got all of the weight and the representation of your advocate. Going back to the idea of golf, I said I play golf a few times a year. Most years I'm gonna play in at least one event called a scramble. I don't know if you played golf much. This is a great, wonderful thing in golf called a scramble. And what a scramble is four guys, not one golfer, but four golfers, they get together and they form a team, right? And so my shots are not my shots. My shots are the best shot of the group. And if you want to be on a great scramble, every good scramble team has this thing called an A player. And the A player on a scramble team typically is the best golfer you can find, or sometimes higher, the best golfer you can get to come and play with you. And typically they're like a scratch golfer. They're really good. They play all the time. And so what's wonderful about playing with an A player is that my drives are not my drives. My drives are his drives. My wedges are not my wedges. They're his wedges. My putts are not my putts. They're his putts. Every great shot that he hits is actually my shot. And my score then is not my score. Realistically, my score is his score. Jesus, if I can say it to you this way, is our A player. When we come to God and we think somehow, because we're better than other people, that somehow what we're going to do is we're going to attain this level of good. What the law says is that while you may be good, and that's okay, this bar is good enough, and you're never going to jump the good enough bar. But that's okay, because you had the Messiah, the high priest come from God, who represents you to him. And what Jesus did when he came is he lived a perfect life, died a perfect death, and he jumped the good enough bar for you and me on the cross, resurrected on the third day to beat death. And these verses say that he ever lives to make intercession for you. What does that mean? That means that he lives to represent you to God. So what happens then in my mind, I used to think about Jesus being my representative, kind of like this, like Jesus would kind of, you know, step in front of God and he'd be like, okay, God, here's Dean and he's a slacker and he messed up again. Promise he'd never do that again. Promise he'd never do that again. Promise he'd never do that again. And we all know there's Dean down there doing his best, but he just kind of stinks at trying to live out this Christian life, God. But I'm going to tell you, God, what we really need from you is mercy. We throw ourselves on the mercy. We throw Dean on the mercy of the court. But that would actually make Jesus a bad attorney. Because when an attorney comes in front of a judge and he says, we throw ourselves on the mercy of the court, what does that mean? That means the attorney really has no case. It's not like that at all. I think it's more like Jesus, right? He comes in front of the Father and he's interceding on my behalf. And he says, God, here's Dean. And Dean's a slacker and he messed up here. And he promised he wouldn't do that. He promised he wouldn't do that. He promised he wouldn't do that. And he makes some of the things. But God, when you look at Dean, remember God, Dean is in me. So when you look at Dean, you don't see Dean, you see me. You don't see Dean's failures, you see my work on the cross, because his sins are charged to my account. And I've already paid for his sins, and you're not the kind of God who would charge someone twice for the same sin. So Dean's sins are already paid for. So don't look at Dean, look at me. Don't look at Dean's failures. Look at how I perform perfect righteousness. Don't look at all the times where Dean stubs his toe and fails. Actually, no. Look at me. Don't see Dean sinful, stained. See my perfect righteousness. So what happens is, because he is my advocate, I live in freedom. I don't have to try and jump the good enough bar. So how does that help us? I'll give you at least two really practical ways. There are more than these, but I'll give you at least two really practical ways that helps you. When you see yourself in Christ, not certain of you and your behavior, but certain of his behavior and what he's done and accomplished for you. I'll give you two ways that helps you. Number one, it helps you deal with criticism. Times in our lives, somebody comes along and rightly or wrongly, they'll make an accusation. Somebody will come to you sometime in your life and say, look, you're a jerk. Your words hurt people. You're crass, and the things that you say are mean, and you don't know this, but people walk away from conversations with you and you hurt them. Now, you have one of two responses. If you're a religious person, all your only option is to be your own advocate, is to self-defend. Come up with your own self-defense, right? Because your initial reaction to that is, who are you? You weren't even there. Speaking of that, who made you my judge? What do I care what you say about what I say? Your only response, if you're religious, if you're trying to make the system of righteousness where you're better than everybody else, is that you have to do. You have to do what? You have to prove yourself. There's a completely different way to handle that. If you believe that your life is hidden with Christ in God, then he is your representative. Then you can step back from criticism when someone says, look, you're a jerk. Your words are crass. You hurt people. You can step back and say, you know what, God? I don't think that my words are hurtful, but it doesn't really matter what I think about my words. What really matters is what other people think about my words. And if other people think my words are hurtful, then I probably need to make an adjustment in how I talk to people, how I communicate to other people. And God, please help the Spirit. Your intercession going up to God means what? The Spirit's work is in my life. So help the Spirit to show me when I'm about to say the wrong kinds of words to other people. And you can say back to somebody else who criticizes you, listen, I know I hear what you say about my words, but let me just tell you, it's not just my words. The words that come out of my mouth are one thing, but the thoughts that run through my head are a completely different thing. You would be amazed at the things that I don't say. I'm way worse than you ever imagined that you're ever criticizing me for. So thank you. This will help me. I'll be better. But you don't know the half of it. See, you live in freedom. Because the question, the verdict is already in. You're not guilty. Jesus has earned your righteousness so that you can live in humility. It's a wonderful way to live. So why don't we choose it? Why do we defend ourselves all the time? Why do we have to be right? And I know what some of you are thinking. Well, yeah, Dean, but if you say that, some people are going to go, well, it doesn't really matter what I do. I can do whatever I want. Having the right verdict not only helps you deal with criticism, but it also helps you deal with cynicism. See, if you and I become religious people, relying on our own righteousness as our representation in front of God, the only option for us is to eventually get cynical. The only option for us is to eventually be frustrated, not have joy, not have peace, because we're constantly trying to earn it. We're never living up to a righteous standard. There's always somebody that's presenting either a better life, whether they really have it or not. They're presenting a better life than the one we have. And we're trying, at least in the background of our minds and hearts, to trying to attain something that's not attainable. And so we just get cynical and we start to believe, well, if we don't have it as good as we are, I mean, how could anybody else? How could anybody else have it? So we just get cynical. We sit back and we think, well, they're not really as happy. They're not really as free as they. You know how I know that Abraham beat cynicism? Because the verses that we read say that Abraham gave a tenth of the spoils to Melchizedek, to this priest. He tithed to the priest. It's interesting. A lot of times people will say to me about living generously they'll say things to me like, well, Dean, you know, tithing is Old Testament. We're not really beholden to that in the New Testament. Isn't it interesting that Abraham tithed before the law was ever around? Interesting. And you know, you and I, none of us would roll into Target and pick out the perfect gift for the perfect person, right? That we want to spend as little as we can on, by the way. But we wouldn't go, we'd only get the perfect gift for the perfect person, that little Chip and Joanna Gaines decorative thing that you want to buy for your friend. None of us would go get that, take that off the shelf, walk up to the checkout line in Target and roll through there and go, yeah, I'll pay for those things. But this thing over here, you know what? This one's on you. None of us would do that, right? We expect that there's an exchange that takes place when we go shopping at Target. Amazing to me. Thousands of religious people are gonna attend church today and they're gonna walk away and they're not gonna live in generosity. Why would you do that? I think it just says to our hearts that we're looking for a verdict from a completely different place. You're looking for a verdict from Trevor, your boyfriend, right, to tell you that you're okay. You're looking for a verdict from your career to tell you, hey, good job, pat you on the back. Hey, you're okay. You're looking for a verdict from your mom and dad to tell you you're doing the right things, you're okay. Or flip that script. Your mom and dad who are looking for the verdict that you're good parents and the way you're doing that is looking to the behavior of your kids. Now, what's the problem with that? The problem with that is that your kids make a bad God, your parents make a bad God, Trevor makes a bad God, and your career makes a bad God, and you can't ever get that sense. What do you need? You need an advocate. You need one who's answered the question where the verdict is already in and you've been declared not guilty, so that when you stand in front of God, you are as beautiful as he, and you are as righteous as he, and that you are prepared to spend eternity with him. Because this whole life that you've been living has just been dress rehearsal for the moment when you see him face to face. Pleased this man with men to dwell, Jesus, our Emmanuel. He is God with us, not God with us 2,000 years ago. He was that. But he is God with us right here, right now, today. He ever lives to represent you before the throne of God. If you're here today and you're not a Christian and you've never begun that relationship with Christ, I'll just say, you don't begin that relationship by going to church. You don't begin that relationship by having parents who go to church or grandparents who go to church. Your relationship with God is your relationship with God. He has designed you to be his son or his daughter. If you've never stepped into that reality, today's your day. I'd love to help you do that. Let's pray together. God, thank you that in your kindness, you left heaven, came to earth. That's the real meaning of Christmas. God, we're grateful for the nostalgia and the joy and the sense of family and all those kinds of, but even all those things, God, are reflections of the blessings that you give to us in the person and through the person of Christ. So God, I just pray for anybody who's here today who hasn't yet taken that step, that this would be their moment and their morning. So we continue to pray right now. I'm gonna pray up here. And if you wanna take the step of following Christ today, you can pray with me right there in your seat. Just pray something like this. Jesus, thank you for leaving heaven and coming to earth for me. Thank you for being God with me. And Jesus, today I'm asking that you would forgive my sins and make my heart clean and new. And Jesus, I'm saying that I wanna follow you. I want to walk with you, and I want you to be Lord and God in my life. Thank you for this salvation gift.